First, just say your full name, how you like it to be said.
Adria Gulitzia.
Where do you live and where did you grow up?
I live in Newark, New Jersey. And I grew up, that's a question that's a little bit complicated, but mostly in Shrewsbury, New Jersey and Piscataway, New Jersey. I also lived in Maryland and Georgia and spent a few years up in New Hampshire for high school.
I love Newark, and I like the Newark Museum and all the Portuguese food.
I have never been to the Newark Museum, if you can believe it, but I have been to NJ Pack, and I have eaten in the Iron Bound.
Good. When you meet someone for the first time and they ask you, what do you do? What on earth do you say?
So I work at a mediation nonprofit in Staten Island that provides free and low cost mediation services in a wide variety of cases. And I really love that work. If they get deeper into the conversation, then it might come out that I do coaching. I'm a certified narrative coach. So I do take private clients that way, that I do have this wonderful vocation in ministry among friends as well. So those things might come out, but usually I just start with, I'm a mediator.
And in addition to that, what are some identities that you hold that are important for you and particularly important for other people to know about you?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I don't know that it's been a long time since I've been asked that question. Definitely Quaker's important. Christian's important. I think that being Black has been more important. I remember over my upbringing, I would have people say, oh, you know, what else are you? And I would just say I'm Black, or they'd say, well, where is your family from? And I would say, well, you know, I'm from New Jersey. My dad's from Alabama. My mom's from South Carolina. Or, well, are they both Black? Like, yes, they are. Are their parents Black? Yes, they are. Where are they from? And so that's, I think over time, it's become more important as as that identity has been questioned over time. To say, no, I'm sorry that I don't conform to your expectations of what like a Black American is supposed to look like or sound like, but I promise you, I really am one. I think another identity that's important for me is as, a peacemaker. And that sounds like it's the same thing as mediator, but it isn't quite. Because I have come to see that a lot of where I do my quote do my best work is in reconciling differences and identifying tensions and inviting us to step into those tensions in a way that brings curiosity and openness as opposed to oppositional energy, which sounds, as I say it, like super woo-woo, but but it comes up a lot in conversations about politics. And I feel like in the last 7 years, a lot of conversations have been about politics in one sense or another.
Well, hallelujah about the reconciliation stuff, because I need help reconciling something here, because I come from a background. I was a born again, evangelical, conservative, anti-gay Christian for many years, struggling with being gay until I finally came to my senses and came out and then started moving among Quakers. And it's been like being a foreigner in a foreign land. You know, like I feel like I'm in exile, but I love it. It's my new home. It doesn't feel like home all the time, but it's a place that works for me in lots of ways, except for when things come up like your article, facing evil, finding freedom, how Christ's victory over sin is ours to share today. I hear the word sin and atonement and redemption. And I kind of shudder because that reminds me, that language reminds me of that old time religion that loved me and had me come just as I am, as long as I would continually not be gay. And this whole idea that, you know, like we are just forever bad and we just always have to fight this bad energy inside of us. So I need your help because you wrote this article and there's stuff in here I need to understand.
Well, first off, thank you for sharing that little snapshot about yourself. I saw some of your writings, Peterson, and we didn't talk about this when we were kind of going back and forth via email, but about 10 years ago or 12 years ago, when it seemed like everybody who was anybody was on Quaker. And so I knew a little bit of your story, but I don't think I had grasped fully the depth of your, of that conservative evangelical background and how that has shaped you. So I'll just say a little bit about myself. I was raised Baptist. I was raised, and people say Southern Baptist, and I just chuckle. because as an American Black person whose family has roots in the South, even if doctrinally there's a lot of overlap, people don't necessarily always know, unless they happen to know, that Southern Baptists splintered off because they insisted on maintaining slavery for as long as possible, and then segregation and all of that fun stuff. So no, not Southern Baptist, but I grew up with a lot of that language, minus the evangelical culture. And I didn't even realize that evangelical culture was like a thing until I went to law school and was in Christian Legal Fellowship. And, you know, about half of us were mainline and half were evangelical, and the evangelicals knew the same songs and they knew the same, they'd all grown up on VeggieTales. It's like, oh, this is a whole world that I didn't know about. Actually, I knew about it before then, just my experience among friends. I was at the Young Adult Friends Gathering in 2010 in Wichita, and there were a few evangelical friends there. I was thrilled to be among other, you know, be able to interact with other Christ-centered friends because I was in a liberal friends meeting at that time. But I didn't know any of those evangelical, like, worship songs and things like that. And I remember someone said to me, well, you know, hymns don't really prove that you're Christian because lots of people who are not Christian sing hymns. And I was like, I'm sorry, I grew up in a Baptist church singing these hymns, and you mean to tell me they're not like Christian enough? And so it was like an interesting moment of, you know, kind of who's in, who's out line drawing, that I've thought a lot about over the years. But you asked, about sin and atonement and reconciliation. And so I'll start there, but I'm going to start with a little story. So a couple years ago, or maybe it was last year, I feel like I'm in a time war, to be honest with you sometimes, but, I facilitated a workshop, two workshops. One was called The Lamb's War for Racial Justice. And the next was called The Lamb's War for the Soul of Our Nation, which was scarcely a month after the insurrection on January 6th, right? The encroachment on the Capitol and attempt to disrupt the certification proceedings for the presidential election. I wanted to talk about the Lamb's War, about, you know, what does it mean to be a people who, as the Bible verse goes, you know, don't fight against flesh and blood, but against the powers and principalities. And what does that actually mean in a context where there are forces that are in opposition to each other? Where should we stand and how should we think about that as friends? And someone asked a question, you know, why does it have to be a war at all? I don't want to fight anybody. Why can't it be the Lamb's Garden? And I realized in that moment that I had started the conversation in the wrong place, that you can't actually talk about the Lamb's War until you can talk about evil. And it's hard to talk about evil unless you can talk about sin. And so when this call for articles came out, I thought, oh, this is a really good time to start at the beginning and to really have the conversation about what is sin, what is evil, how do we reconcile the existence of evil with the goodness of God? How can we reconcile the existence of evil within each of us with our belief in that of God in every person? And what did early friends have to say about that?
So when I got involved with Quakers, I heard this phrase over and over and over again, that of God in you, and that people are inherently good, and we just have to get past all the little blockages in the way to get this like wonderful little nugget of goodness on the inside, and that no one actually is bad or evil. It's just that they're confused or they're misguided or out of balance. So like, how do you reconcile though? Because people do some really awful things. And you write in your article, by minimizing the very real spiritual corruption that scars so many of us in body and soul, this approach can leave us floundering when we inevitably encounter hypocrisy, aggression, and selfishness in ourselves or in others. And so, like, is there evil? Can people be evil?
So that is such a great, 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 great question. You know, that tension between, okay, that of God in every person, and what I believe is really the fundamental goodness of creation and the reality of evil. To start with that of God in every person, I think it is a very hopeful and lovely idea that people really just want to be good, and that if only we could just enlighten everybody, then all of our problems would be solved. That's not the message that drew me to Friends, and it doesn't really match up with my reality, unfortunately, though I wish it did. I went through a long period of searching growing up. Like I said, I was raised Baptist. I was turned off of my, you know, from my Baptist church because there was a lot of culture war type preaching, you know, and I'm sure you've heard it. And I'm sure you know exactly what I mean when I say, you know, God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. And that was what was coming a lot from the pulpit rather than what I saw as the priorities of Christ in his ministry. It didn't right. feel like the focus was as much on the gospel. But I did my own period of spiritual searching. I tried for a while to be agnostic because it seemed more urbane. That was my black turtleneck phase. And yes, I actually did have a black turtleneck phase. Then I took a class on Islam, really thought Islam was amazing, just the passion. Of course, I didn't realize, as I know now, that there are plenty of casual Muslims like there are casual Christians. As I was doing my searching, one of the things that I realized that kept me self-identifying as Christian was the reality that Paul says in one of his epistles that, you know, I don't do the good that I want to do, but instead I do the evil that I don't want to do. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean that my flesh is so weak that I want to be good? I want to be patient. I want to be generous all the time. I don't want to be lazy. I don't want to be angry. And yet I am. And I couldn't, quote, enlighten myself out of that.
Yeah. I lived in that Romans 6 chapter for years.
and so that evil is real. And the other piece is, you know, early friends said, and this really resonates with me, listen, there is the light of Christ that enlightens every person who comes into the world. That's real. But a lot of times people don't want to listen. Yes, God is speaking, but a lot of times people don't want to listen. I remember one time in some of my early days around among friends, I met someone in a library who was hitting on me, was trying to pick me up. He was an older person, but he kept, you know, I spent a lot of time in the library and he was trying to pick me up. I came into a Quaker space and saw that man with his wife and his children. He wasn't confused about the morality of what he was doing. Mm. He wasn't like, oh, I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to try to make dates with people while I was married and a father. And so the idea that, you know, if only people were less confused, they would do everything right, just doesn't resonate with my experience. Hmm.
You talk about this bold and audacious claim, one of the most controversial elements of traditional Quaker faith. And it really shows how Quakers saw things differently, early Quakers, than they do today, but then even of other Christians of their day. Like, and I think they were charged with like saying like people can be perfect. Absolutely. Maybe some people misunderstood that, right? But there was something there that they were preaching that gave people a lot of hope and joy. What can you say about that?
Absolutely. And I think that's where it goes full circle, because if we say, okay, creation was made to be good, that God made this world so that it could be good. God made humanity so that we could reflect nobility and righteousness and generosity and love for each other and for all of creation. But something happened and we don't do that. And early friends would say that was Adam's fall. That's not how, so that reality of evil that we've spoken about isn't how we were meant to be as men and women and people in this world. That's not how we were meant to be at all. We were meant to be good. We were created in God's image. And just as Adam's fall and Eve's fall condemned humanity, Christ's triumph redeemed humanity and brought us back into the, into that image of God that we were meant to be in. And that if we will stop and wait and listen to what God has to say, and then, and this is important, we can't just listen to it and hear it. We actually have to obey it. But if we do that, then we can live into that perfect creation that we were meant to be.
What about Quakers in North America and Europe and parts of Africa who are non-theist, who are not Christians?
So here's what I can say, and then we can see whether or not it makes sense to keep it in. One thing that I'm very, very clear of about is that it is not for me to judge anybody's faith or lack of faith. What I can do is testify to the experience that I've had. And for me, as a young adult of 20 years old, reading George Fox's journal, I was literally sitting in my college dorm hollering out loud at what I was reading, saying, oh my goodness, you know, this is what I would have said about the gospel if only I had known to say it. So for me, my path into Quakerism was actually a way of encountering the gospel and living it in a way that just felt so saturated with truth and reality that it was irresistible to me. One of the things I appreciated about Islam when I was studying it, and obviously even now, is that it had a developed theology of other religions. How should we think about Christians? How should we think about Jews? This is something that Muslim thinkers had thought about, and that's reflected in the Quran and the Hadith. I appreciated that Quakerism had this theology of other religions, that Christ is active and working, including in people who don't confess Christ, might be adherents of other religions, including for people who may not know may not believe that God exists. It is not for me to judge anybody else's faith, and I certainly hope that that my experience and my faith would not be a stumbling block to others. But when I read that, you know, Christ is the true light who enlightens every person coming into the world, my heart leaps and it has the savor of truth for me. And so that's all I can testify to is what I know and what I've experienced. I tell people sometimes, you know, I'm a modern woman, but I'm not modern enough or postmodern enough to deny my own experience of reality. And so that's, but other people have their own experience of reality, and that's what they have to reckon with. And, you know, as early friends, we're fond of saying we each have to work out our own salvation with fear and trembling. So I know that there are many, many thoughtful non-theist friends, who have thought a lot about different things and have a deep and rich spiritual life. And I wish them the very best.
I'm also a Christ-centered Quaker, and I find it's far easier to come out gay among liberal friends than to come out Christian. Like, even saying the word Christian is, like, challenging. And so we have this Christ-centered friend language, which feels to me like I'm cheating or not being completely honest. But I understand that, like, that's the culture I'm in. But that's when I feel like I'm a foreigner in a foreign land, and I'm in exile from the places where I liked to worship, but there were too many structural problems and theological problems to make it possible.
So that's really interesting to hear, and it's funny because the longer I stay among friends, the more I have to like break through the desire to like fit in a little bit. But I make it a point to worship and seek fellowship with other Christian friends. And, you know, my whole family is Baptist. And so I spend a lot of time, worshiping with non-Quaker Christians. And I find that it's good for me in my own discipleship journey. Because I love friends of all stripes. And I've had some wonderful, wonderful times connecting with evangelical friends and wonderful, wonderful times connecting with FUM friends and wonderful, wonderful times connecting with liberal friends of a whole wide range of theologies. And I also know that for me personally, to continue growing into the likeness of Christ, it's really important for me to seek out refreshment and renewal, in that distinctly Christian way.
Anything else that you like to say about, sin, evil, redemption, atonement?
Okay. Yes. Ooh. Okay. So sometimes people think that by acknowledging the reality of sin, that what you're saying is somebody is terrible all the way through.
Mm.
That, oh, you're a bad person and I shouldn't have anything to do with you. And I think that that is a big part of why it's so hard for us to confront sin in our meetings and in ourselves. You know, I've been in meetings with active sex addicts. I've been in meetings where sexual harassment was happening in the meeting. I shared a story of, you know, that was somebody who was in a Quaker space. It wasn't a Quaker, but, you know, what do we do when lines are crossed in our meetings where it's clear that evil is at work, that gossiping and backbiting that happens after meeting for worship with a concern for business sometimes, the talebearing that happens when there's a big dispute, you know, at a yearly meeting, annual gathering? That's all evil. And I think sometimes we hesitate to say that because we want to be loving to each other. And we feel like by calling that out, we're saying you're a bad person all the way through. But the reality is all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. If there is a perfect person, I haven't met them. Even from a Christian perspective, the only perfect person was Jesus and they crucified him. So we have to be able to hold that tension of, I love you and what you're doing right now isn't okay. And we see so much that we struggle with that. I mean, the work that Cody Hirsch and Wendy Cooler have done and Jade Rockwell have done around abuse in our Quaker spaces. A big part of the struggle in dealing with abuse and keeping our community safe is that we don't know how to hold in tension the I love you, I respect you, I admire you, and what you're doing is wrong. And I think that by being able to say, you know what? Evil is not something that crops up every once in a while. Sin is not something that crops up every once in a while. Sin is a reliable feature of the human condition. So how do we think about how we address it before it happens? We know it's going to happen. So what do we do when it happens? Let's think about that now so that we don't have to flounder for it when our backs are against the wall when we're dealing with a crisis. If we have a culture where we can admit and we're encouraged to admit, to confess to each other our struggles, you know, I know that I have certain struggles. And I've done life transformation groups and I have some spiritual friends where I can share what those struggles are. And they can ask me, how is that going? What are you doing? What safeguards do you need to have in your life so that those struggles don't get the better of you? But in order to be able to have those conversations, we really need to know each other. We need to go beyond superficial chat in our fellowship time to create spaces where people can say, you know what? I'm not doing okay. I don't like the way I'm parenting my kids. I need help. I don't like the way I'm showing up at my job. I need help. I don't like these feelings that I'm feeling all the time. I need help. We need to create trust where we can do that, where we can be vulnerable with each other, which, by the way, we also see that, you know, that's a big problem in the conversation around white supremacy. People feel that I don't want to be a racist. So there can be a lot of defensiveness when somebody calls out or lifts up, hey, you know, this thing that you did wasn't okay. This thing that you said wasn't okay. And people hear that and they say, but I'm not a racist. What they're really feeling is, but I'm not a bad person. We need to get rid of that binary and be able to say, you're a wonderful person and you have a struggle. Well, of course you have a struggle. Like, we all have struggles. And that struggle in particular is like, is baked in to the American project. That doesn't mean you're a bad person. But let's sit with that and see, you know, where God is calling us in that. And so the ability to say, yes, evil is real. Yes, sin is real. And that's not the totality of who you are. And what kind of accompaniment and walking alongside do you need to help you live into the fullness that God is calling you into? And to be able to do that with trust and with love and with the knowledge that we can still love each other and be in community with each other. That requires a willingness to really labor with each other. One, to come into like a shared vision of, you know, what does evil look like? I've heard friends say things. There was a whole series of New York Times articles a few years back about corporal punishment. And you hear friends say things like, spanking should be illegal. Well, there's a lot of research about the harm that can be done in corporal punishment. But as a starting point, that's going to make a hard point of conversation if you have 97% of Americans who've admitted 97% of American parents who have admitted to spanking or slapping their child at least once, and this common view among certain categories of friends that, quote, spanking should be illegal. Well, if I know that you feel that spanking should be illegal, I'm not going to say to you probably, oh, you know, I gave my child a spanking last night and I'm really struggling and I'm looking for better ways to handle their behavior. Because you're not going to be a safe person to talk to. Because I already know you think that I should be thrown in jail. So what? I don't know what the solution is to that problem, but I do know that if we want to create communities where people can be honest with each other about their struggles, we have to, one, be really mindful of our language, the way that we talk about things, that we are just saturated in compassion and tenderness for one another. And we have to be willing to trust our communities to buoy us up and to help us out of some behaviors and some attitudes that are not of God. And that would be a big culture shift, because a lot of friends, at least, you know, in my neck of the woods among friends, the kind of liberal, unprogrammed, more Northeastern friends, are a lot of times really, really saturated in a very firm culture of, the best thing about being a Quaker is that nobody tells you what to do. How dare you offer an opinion on my behavior? I'm not here to be judged. Let's just live and let live. If everybody's fine, if everybody's doing well, that's great. But if somebody's really struggling, live and let live is not really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
what's helpful is kind of support and spiritual intimacy. So that there would be a big culture change, but I think we could do it if we wanted.
Yeah. As a white person, particularly white male, I see how this works with racism. And before you brought it up, I was thinking about that, how resistant some of us white folks are about acknowledging that I'm racist, or this is a racist thought, this was a racist act. But how could we not be, having been raised in a culture that just is saturated in all of this white supremacy? I mean, I marinated it in it for decades and still do. And there are thoughts and ideas and actions that, you know, are need to be examined. And it's not that I'm actively engaging in hate, but it doesn't discount the reality of, like, what's in my head, what's in my society, what I've been trained to do and to think. That's, you know, but we are, I think that is so hard if someone is in any way, and I think this is true among liberal friends, white friends, in any way seen as doing something that's racist, it becomes this judgment of you're a horrible person. And how can you be a person, you know, with complexity? And I think this is so true with American films and all, where it's only been recently we've been seeing some nuance in characters, but for so long, it's just the good guy versus the bad guy. And that there's no room for people to be the good guy, the protagonist, who's incredibly flawed and does something really awful. And similarly, you know, the bad guys just has to have complete evil, bad intentions. And because we don't know how to deal with these nuances, or we haven't been trained, or as you're saying, we just don't have the culture for it, it seems.
I think I really, really appreciate that point about nuance. And I'm just going to gush for just a moment. One of my favorite shows is, probably my very favorite show, honestly, is Marvel's Daredevil. And people would say, like, how could you possibly, what kind of Quaker are you? It is an incredibly violent show and it's graphic. So if that is something that you have trouble with, do not watch. But as somebody who was weaned on kung fu films, the choreography is amazing. And the fact that he is a Christian superhero trying to navigate keeping his city safe from drug traffickers, from human traffickers, from muggers, and at the same time live an authentically, like, Christian and righteous life. It makes it such an interesting show. And similarly, the big bad Kingpin, as portrayed in Daredevil, is someone for whom, watching, I had so much sympathy. And so having those shows, having those cultural experiences, I mean, to go way back, right? I mean, we've always had some. If you think about a film like The Godfather, to see these men celebrating a wedding, holding a baby, being genuinely tender and loving, and at the same time, ruthless killers. And what does that mean? How do we grapple with that? I butcher this. It might've been Solzhenitsyn who said the line between good and evil cuts through every human heart, or something like that. That's a reality, but we all want to be the good guy. We all want to be the hero. And the fact of the matter is, even the best of us can't be perfect all the time. And that's not that, but that doesn't mean that you're rotten all the way through and ready for the trash heap. What that means is that you're in need of God's grace, and you're in need of grace from other people. And we know that instinctively with the people that we love the most. My son, when he was 6 months old, was playing with another baby, and the baby took his little toy and he cried. We gave him the toy back. The second time, the other baby, who was maybe 3 or 4 months old, took his toy, my son bit him. Nobody had to teach him how to bite. And mm-hmm. biting is not how we, you know, we solve conflicts. But I didn't like throw him away because he bit another kid. You know, we work on that. We grow. We hurt each other in our families all the time. And yet we forgive. For the most part, we forgive. What would it look like to extend that kind of grace and forgiveness and understanding to not just the people that we live with or gave birth to or married or selected to be our life companions, but to other members of our Quaker community, to other members of our local community, to other members of our national community, to other members of our political community. That good and bad, that tension mm-hmm. is real for everyone. But it's not fun to have to navigate it because nobody wants to be on the wrong line of it. And it's also hard, like it's painful to extend grace to like those people, you know? I had an article in Friends Journal on the peace testimony. One of the letters was that, you know, she thought it was the writer thought it was interesting, but objected to my use of exclusive language. I think I referred to God as him. And so she didn't continue reading the piece. And she was disappointed to see that kind of exclusive language among friends. What does it mean to be a people who say there's that of God in everyone? When we can't listen or feel like that we are not called to listen across language that is hard. Because when we're with people who are like ourselves, who we like, who we get along with, the fact that there's that of God in everyone, you know, is a source of bonding. But we don't really need to believe that to bond with people who are like us because we would bond with them on a human level. But what does right. it mean to respect the humanity of people who we think are deeply mistaken or even evil? It's hard. It's hard. It feels gross. It feels icky. Like, how can I love you when you're a racist? How can I love you when you're a sexist? How can I love you when you're a xenophobe? As a Christian, I would say those are precisely the people that that Christ calls us to love with intention. There's no credit, as he said, to love somebody who loves you. Mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. no credit to love somebody who treats you well. The real question is, can you love somebody who treats you badly? Can you love somebody who you disagree with? Can you love somebody who you find disgusting? That's a discipline. It's a spiritual discipline. And it's not one that's very much encouraged, but I think that it's not one that's very much encouraged in the time that we're in now, particularly, which is so polarized. And it's very easy to say, well, you know, those liberal Democrats on the one hand, or those MAGA Republicans on the other hand, and not give them grace. But that's the job. That's the Lamb's War. That's the heart of it. And so you can't get there until you recognize the same evil that I see in that person is in me as well. But the same God that can set me free from that evil can set them free from that evil as well. And what does it look like to love them and walk with them through that process?
Yeah. Well, we are at time. And I have more than enough and decide how to use it all, but I could always put an extended version of it up as well. I'm sure you're going to get lots of letters and we'll get lots of feedback from lots of friends with all sorts of opinions, but I'll do it. I love chatting with you. I love your perspective. And I'm really excited we got to chat today.
I really, really, really appreciated it, Peterson. It was really great. And I will be looking to see what comes out of this. And it's been really nice to just have an opportunity to connect with you. Because like I said, I think I was a law student when I first saw, you know, Peterson Toscano. What was the name of your blog?
Amusing.
There you go. There you go. Those were the days, Peterson.
The Blogspot days. Oh, my goodness. Now I'm on TikTok. Huh.
Yeah, right.